Invite you to say hello to somebody nearby. Just greet a person next to you or stand up and say hello to someone. That's great. Good for you. Thank you. Well done. I hope you, if you're here and not often or usually here, I hope you were made to feel welcome. There's a universal human longing that Jesus addressed with an invitation. Come to me, all who labor and are heavy laden, and I will give you rest. The invitation is not come to me and I will remove every burden from your life. Jesus does not, in fact, he goes on to say he would lay upon us his yoke, which is easy, and give us rest for our souls. His point in issuing the invitation to come to him is that we would learn of him and, mysteriously taking on his yoke, find that the heaviness that wearies our hearts has been lifted, that our souls have been given new freedom, that even in the midst of hard circumstances, rest is possible. We're studying this summer, weeks this summer, the old New Testament story, four chapters long, the story of Ruth, the book of Ruth, and we'll come to chapter 3 today, and it begins with Naomi using language somewhat similar to Jesus. She says to her daughter, "Should I not seek rest for you that it may be well with you?" But Naomi doesn't understand where rest comes from. She is herself a restless person, and her thoughts on how to provide rest for others we'll find, I think, are counterproductive at best. She wants a good life for her daughter. There's no question of that. And she's savvy enough to know that if Ruth benefits, she will ultimately benefit herself. Her intentions, however, are good, mostly good. She wants a good thing. But as far as she's concerned, again, rest depends on positive circumstances, on financial abundance, on agreeable relationships, on a secure future. We might look back to chapter 1 where she told the two daughters-in-law before the one left the family. She said, she asked that God would, praise for them. "May the Lord grant that you find rest, each of you in the house of her husband." While they were still in Moab, before they left, she wants them to find rest in the house of a husband. But then she goes on to say, "Not for me. There will be no husband for me. There will be no children for me. The Lord, hand of the Lord is against me. The Lord has dealt bitterly with me." And so she's hoping for rest for others. She is at a loss to speak of anything like that for herself. And I think what we'll discover is the inability to find peace in God's presence alone that evidences itself in Naomi's stridency on the one hand is the other side of the coin to the instinct to take the reins and make things happen when you have an opportunity to do so. Grousing and controlling are two sides of the same coin in some ways. And I think Naomi's, she is loved by God. She is going to be encircled in love before she's done. But we're learning from her in some ways as a negative example, at least up to this point. Our souls long for rest, and it begins with letting God reign. Jesus' yoke provides rest for our hearts as we trust in him first, inwardly and have his response, his presence express itself in our experience. We've said that one way to read this book is to see two widows, two women, each childless, each widowed, each poor, Ruth and Naomi. And in one case, we have Naomi struggle with God, and in another case, we have Ruth trust him. To use the language, use language later in the New Testament, in the book of Hebrews, Ruth entered into God's rest before she knew how he would act. And that's what I'm proposing we learn from her today for ourselves. So let's go back then to our text, beginning in verse 1 of chapter 3. Then Naomi, Ruth's mother-in-law, said to her, "My daughter, should I not seek rest for you, that it may be well with you? Is not Boaz our relative with whose young women you were? See, he is winnowing barley tonight at the threshing floor." So just again to kind of recapture the context and stuff we've seen already, Boaz, we are assuming to be an older man. He is an older man, certainly. We know that for sure. We assume that he is both widowed and the father of grown children. There's good reasons to make that assumption. Ruth is a younger, is young and poor and childless. She is also widowed. And each of them had been on a God journey. They were unaware of it. They were responding to what they knew of God and his purposes. They were taking one day at a time. And these journeys led them to connect with one another one fine day, one surprising day, in a barley field. And that's pretty much where we ended up last week. They, having met one another, spent most of the 2 months it would take for both barley and wheat to be harvested, saw each other each day, and we can sort of, in our imaginations, see things develop. The point that any thoughtful reader of this book has arrived at by now is that these two ought to be married. You can't have read romantic novels of any kind. You can't have seen Hollywood movies of any sort. You can't have read books from, you know, as far back as books go, and know anything about stories, and not know that the narrator of this story has drawn these folks together. They ought to get married. How will it happen? How will the deal get done? The proposal get made? That's the question. And we're at that point now. We don't know how it's going to happen. We know that it ought to happen. Each of these two is able, and this is an important reason we know they belong together. Each of them is able to speak to the other in terms that God uses to bless. They are given, each of them, the gift of language to upbuild the other, to touch the other, a way of bringing the Lord's presence into the life of the other. And that means to us as readers, as we look on, they belong together. They belong in that role, God's servant to the other, speaking his truth each to the other for the rest of their lives. We also sense that they're in love. Day after day in the fields and seeing one another. We know the first day they met, they conversed. Perhaps every day they did. And they're more drawn to each other over time. And one way, I think, to suggest that to us or to observe that is that each of them think they are unworthy of the other. And that, to me, is almost always the best evidence that someone is in love, is to say, why would someone like you look at someone like me? I don't deserve the person you are. I know me, and I don't deserve you. And it's that each of them think that of the other. Ruth, because of her status. I don't, why would you look at me? Boaz, because of his age. Why would you choose me? And yet we sense that they're delighted to be chosen by the other, and there's this, they're in love. I think we can make that observation. The last thing that is telling us that they belong together as a married couple is a reference to the words of God, to the law of Israel. Because the law provides two important things. First, that a family without a male heir should have its last widow, its youngest widow, its some woman who's left in the family, should marry a relative, have a child. That child should bear the name of the deceased person so the family line does not get extinguished. Well, that's exactly the case here. Someone should marry, and Ruth, especially because she's young enough to certainly have children, someone should marry her, and the law provides for that. And Boaz is called by Naomi at the end of chapter 1, a goel, a kinsman redeemer. He fits the bill. Secondly, a kinsman redeemer, a family member, should buy back the forfeited property so that it doesn't get dissipated and lost from Israel's history. And once again, Boaz is in a position to do that, to buy the property of Elimelech and Mahlon, the two father and son who have died, Ruth's husband, Mahlon, someone should buy back the property for the family. Someone should marry the widow, have a son who has the name of the deceased. Someone should do that. And that is all in the air because Boaz has been named a kinsman redeemer. We know that he's, you know, in God's economy, he stands in the place where he can do what needs to be done. So they are servants of the Lord to each other. They are in love with each other. The law has created circumstances that push them together as well. So how will they end up getting married? And this is where Naomi thinks she knows what to do. She will step in and get the proposal to happen. Verse 3. Wash, therefore, and anoint yourself. That is, put on a fragrance, perfume. Put on your cloak, that is not your work clothes, your best clothes. Go down to the threshing floor, but do not make yourself known to the man until he has finished eating and drinking. But when he lies down, observe the place where he lies. Then go and uncover his feet and lie down, and he will tell you what to do. And she replied, all that you say, I will do. Naomi's advice has some pretty clear assumptions behind it. There's a fair amount of sexual energy, frankly, in the description that we've just read in these verses. We first note the place. It's a secluded place, at least there's a chance to be alone. It's dark. It's night. There's been a party. Threshing and time is followed at the end by a party, and we find out in verse 7 that there's been drinking because everyone's a little tipsy at the end of the party. Everything about the physical circumstances of this event suggest something like sexual energy. The party's over, what's going to happen? The word used here to lie down is also a word that, if it were in a different context, could describe sexual intercourse. Someone lies with his wife and she conceives and so on. That word sometimes could be used that way, although it doesn't have to be and isn't to hear explicitly. The particular phrase, to uncover one's feet, has come in for some academic discussion. And there are some who claim that it is quite brazenly a euphemism for, feet is actually a euphemism for genitals. And this is a very explicit, highly sexual, very brazen sort of bit of advice. I don't think that makes sense in this context. It's not the way the book is written. There's no reason. I think the best scholarship is actually against that interpretation. But the wordplay and kind of all that's in this description, that Naomi's plan of attack, it is, I think, quite sexualized in many respects. And it's not even sort of apologized for. That Naomi knows they ought to get married, and that means physical connection. This isn't a story of first love, awakening, discovery of one's feelings and one's. These are all people who've been married before. They know what it's like to be married. They know they can make clear assumptions about what is going to happen being married. Naomi just wants to take advantage of that and use it for what she knows and we know and everybody knows is a good end. What she's intent upon is letting nature take its course. Let's use that our human nature to our advantage. Proximity and perfume, testosterone and flattery, all can be sort of wrapped together in a way that gets us where we want to go. And why shouldn't it? Naomi is of the mind, I think, that human beings have appetites, and appetites can be channeled to get you where you want to go. There's an old saying, some will say that the best way to a man's heart is through his stomach. You ever heard that you know, if you feed sort of the guy, he'll be interested in you. And this is libido is another kind of appetite that can be used to one's advantage. Ruth is not at any point shocked by the earthiness of this whole thing. She understands life too. But she does not carry out the plan as Naomi intended to it. She knows better that if she hopes to have rest in the house of her husband for the rest of his life, the best way to get there is not to nibble on his ear late at night in a compromising moment. She ends up, as we shall see, talking to him about what the Lord would have for them. She has in mind more important things. Strong feelings and vague intentions are not enough. You need structure. That's why marriages take place in public settings with others looking on. This whole town, it turns out, will be blessed by the marriage of these two. You make vows to one another. You don't just connect physically and carry on from there. Marriage is a bigger and more important thing than that. It's not foreign to this environment, but it's not made up of these things alone. And so when Naomi connects with Boaz, she's going to speak to him about their concern, their mutual concern to do what God wants them to do. Last thing we might note before we move on is that Naomi was willing to risk Ruth's reputation to get the ball moved down the field, to get the work accomplished. Boaz is later unwilling to risk her reputation. He makes sure that no one sees that she had been there. It's not clear that Naomi would have cared particularly. As long as we get where we're going, what happens to Ruth's reputation, it doesn't come up, at least for Naomi, but it is a matter of significant importance to Boaz. So this is, I'm sure there's a great many things about this culture that we don't know, and it's probably foolish of me to make all of the assumptions I'm making about what opportunities they had, how could they have done it different, what options did they have. But at least one thing we know is that Boaz is not a hard person to talk to about important things. We've heard Boaz and Ruth speak of the ways of God and the possibilities, and Boaz longs to be a blessing to his workers. It cannot have been hard for someone to talk to Boaz about his status as a kinsman redeemer without first having this nighttime scene on the threshing floor. But for whatever reason, it has not yet come up until Ruth brings it up as we come to it at the end, in the next verses. I think Naomi believed that the ends justify the means, that the best way to get where you want to go is to use things you can control. Don't take a lot of risks with outcomes. Manipulate your way to the next stage. Verse 6. So Ruth went down to the threshing floor and did just as her mother-in-law had commanded her. And when Boaz had eaten and drunk and his heart was merry, that is tipsy, it's the end of the party, he went to lie down at the end of the heap of grain. She came softly and uncovered his feet and lay down. At midnight, the man was startled and turned over, and behold, a woman lay at his feet. He said, "Who are you? What are you doing here?" And she answered, "I am Ruth, your servant. Spread your wings over your servant, for you are a redeemer." Key phrase there is you are a redeemer. You have a responsibility. We together have a responsibility. There is a family in Israel that will be extinguished if you are not, or someone is not willing to be a goel. If someone is not willing to buy back my family's property, willing to have a child by me with the name of Mahlon and Elimelech and so on. You're a redeemer. She didn't, as Naomi might have intended, she didn't waft her perfume towards him when he woke up. She didn't remind him of the lonely bed at home and suggest that he might imagine all the possibilities of romantic nights to come. Rather, she spoke about something greater than sexual desire. The phrase she uses, "spread your wings on your servant," it's a word that can mean the part of his garment, part of his cloak, spread your cloak over me. But it is also the word that was used in chapter 2 when Boaz said, "You have come to seek refuge under the wings of God." The loving, protective, honorable covering of God. And she uses his language again and say, "Be God's servant. Spread your wings as God's wings on the one who needs to be married for God's reasons, not just our own desires. She's asking for an honorable marriage. The proposal has been made, if you will. The land and the lineage of her former family is at stake. She sought God's best and reached out to the man who put the things of God before himself. But as it turns out, we'll see in a moment, in doing this, in not taking the approach that gets Boaz to act for more selfish, more kind of immediate reasons, in invoking the plan of God, she's taking a risk because it turns out there is another relative that should step in first. We'll see that in a moment. By asking Boaz to be the Goel, the kinsman redeemer, the threat is this. You would measure the closeness of relatives. I'm not sure quite how, but your brother would be the first closest. Your uncle might be the next closest. Your cousin the next closest. Anyway, there's relative degrees of who's the next relative close by. And there's someone else who should step into this role first. And by saying, we want to do what the Lord would have us do for his sake, they're taking the risks that they might not be married at all, even though we know they very much long to be married to each other at this point. So I was thinking, this caused me to think a bit about the marriage proposal that I made to my bride. And there's a great irony in this. It's mini irony in this. So I was born on Valentine's Day. And I turn out to be the least romantic person I've ever been. I have no, sense at all. So I asked Les to marry me. We were together in a place. She had a friend who was a disadvantaged single mom who had a violent boyfriend. And we were helping with these kids. And we were, so all this stuff swirling around. And I had spent an awful lot of time praying. We had prayed together. I'd sought advice of pastors and mentors and friends. A lot of time spent on, is this the right thing for us to be married? And I took that seriously. But the actual proposal itself was no flowers, no candles, no soft music. Just kind of late at night, I sort of say, hey, you want to get married? But, I'm pretty sure I got down on a knee and asked her to marry me. But it was just like, but I'm sort of comforted by this marriage proposal. In the middle of the night, they're on a threshing floor for crying out loud. So now again, I don't know why I tell that story. It just occurred to me, I suppose. But what Ruth is doing is sort of inviting God's best into their relationship, and as we'll see, there is a risk. Verse 10. And he said, "May you be blessed by the Lord, my daughter. You have made this last kindness greater than the first, in that you had not gone after young men, whether poor or rich. And now, my daughter, do not fear. I will do for you all that you ask, for all my fellow townsmen know that you are a worthy woman, a woman of great worth. And now it is true I am a redeemer, yet there is a redeemer nearer than I. Remain tonight, and in the morning, if he will redeem you, let him do it. But if he is not willing to redeem you, then as the Lord lives, I will redeem you. Lie down until morning." So she lay at his feet until the morning, but arose before one could recognize another. And he said, let it not be known that the woman came to the threshing floor. He says to her, "You are a woman of great worth. Everybody knows you are a noble person. A woman, Moabite or not, poor or not, you are of great worth in all the things that count. And everybody knows that. And the last thing in the world I want is for our time together this evening to imply something about you that is not true." And so he wants to tell her how much she's worth. He also wants to protect her reputation by how they carry out the rest of the plan. And again, I think this is just more sense that he is somebody who wants to serve her. Wants to serve her for God's sake. The other thing that I have found myself sort of wondering about, trying to be in this story imaginatively, is what happened. So in the middle of the night, he woke up and talked to her. They have this conversation, and she says, And both of them realize we need to act for the sake of people who are now dead. That's important to us, and it's important to God, and we need to honor other people, and it's not just about us. That's all been, so they have that conversation. And then it says they lay together until, you know, how many hours later, until near daybreak. And I've wondered what they talked about. They can't have just fallen asleep. You know, oh my goodness, our whole world is now, you know, on the verge of changing. And you know, I think they probably prayed together and worried together. Are we going to have this that means a lot to us, that we be together? Is it going to be allowed? And if it isn't, what kind of friendship might we have going forward? And if we are allowed to marry, what will God give us a child? And how will we raise him? And how will we take, you know, all the stuff that you would talk about for hours about seeing a future together and worrying that they'll miss out on it and wondering. There's a kind of intimacy about them being together the rest of that night, knowing what now is in play, but not knowing how it's going to turn out. Verse 15. And he said, "Bring the garment you are wearing and hold it out." So she held it and measured out 6 measures of barley and put it on her. Then she went into the city. And when she came to her mother-in-law, she said, "How did you fare, my daughter?" That is, Naomi said. And, you know, it's kind of like, give me the details. What happened? You know, it sent you out there, perfume, looking good, you know, all night long. What happened? What happened? How did you fare, my daughter? Let's see. Then Ruth told her all that the man had done for her, saying, "These 6 measures of barley he gave to me, for he said to me, 'You must not go back empty-handed to your mother-in-law.'" It's kind of a great line. Knowing Naomi as we do, she'll appreciate some tangible evidence that things are turning the right direction. Verse 18, she replied, "Wait, my daughter, until you learn how the matter turns out, for the man will not rest, but he will settle this matter today." So one of Boaz's big concerns is to save Ruth's reputation, to protect her, to protect what others think about her. But he also recognizes that Naomi is, will appreciate very much the tangible evidence that God has not forgotten her. The line, however, that strikes me, because we're sort of seeing this through the prism of how God provides rest, is Naomi's statement in verse 18. "The man will not rest, but will settle the matter today." Now, that's a different Hebrew word than was used before. And in this case, it's not talking about rest in any significant sense. All Naomi means here is he's going to do something real quickly. He's not, no grass growing under his feet. Tomorrow, it's going to happen. Whatever's going to happen is going to happen. It's going to happen quickly. But I think, just again, given that we're asking God questions about what does it mean to rest with the yoke of Jesus, the gift of his rest, it's an interesting statement. He will not rest until he does something. Well, that's exactly wrong, of course. He's resting all along. He and Ruth both have entered into God's rest on some level. They're willing to trust God even though they can't predict what's going to happen. And again, Naomi's statement, I think, just heightens our awareness that rest is something that doesn't depend on being in control, doesn't depend on getting what we want, doesn't depend on running lives as seems best to us. Their hearts were at peace, even though the future was undetermined yet. So, as we do continually in this story, we leave at a cliffhanger moment. Oh no, here it is, the next morning. What will happen now? You probably already know, but we're not going to talk about it today any further. A couple of things I want to say in conclusion. The first one has to do with marriage. And it actually could apply to any serious relationship, family members, parents and children, good friends. And that is this: the time comes up frequently in any important relationship when you will know what's best, when you will have a clear vision of what the future ought to be, when it's obvious to you, whether it is to anybody else, that this is what ought to happen next. And it's possible, because you know it's best, to manipulate the outcome, to use the appetites, the longings, the fears, the self-doubt of your partner, to use those in a way that you position them to get where you think things ought to go. And again, it's not because you've got a bad attitude, you've got a good attitude. You just want to do the right thing. But you manipulate your way to get there. That is deadly for any serious relationship. It's deadly in a marriage. It's deadly in any relationship that's important. It's the idea that without persuading someone to see what's important, without their agreement on some level, without putting it in a context where we're moving forward for good reason, I'm just going to get you to do what I want you to do because I know how to push the buttons. That is destructive of any important relationship. And I think, you know, Ruth refused to do that. She wanted to have, to use the phrase from chapter 1, rest in the home of her husband. And she didn't want to start out by tricking him on some level into doing what was the right thing, as everyone agrees it was the right thing. Lastly, let me observe the obvious, and that is that we live in a time and place that is perhaps the most rest-starved time and place in all human history. Silicon Valley is a desperately fast-paced, high-demand, rest-denying kind of place. It is all about human instrumentation and control and getting what you want and being angry when you don't get it and being determined ever more to do more of it the next time. We are surrounded with people that don't know anything about rest. We are subject to the pressures ourselves. And I think Jesus' invitation ought to ring in our ears as we kind of conclude the morning. Come to me if you're weary and heavy laden. Take my yoke upon you. Let me give you what you can't find for yourself, and that is rest for your soul. Peace of heart. The sovereign of the universe is on your side. The one who controls everything is for you and loves you now. He can be trusted. We can live in that sort of faithful trust. He can give us rest without waiting for us to find the peaceful and perfect world circumstances that we want to live in. Let's pray. Lord, thank you for these old stories. Thank you for a chance to encounter them together as a family. We do pray that we would come to you, Lord, for rest, that you will speak to us in ways that only you can, that your yoke will be easy and light and life-giving to us. In Jesus' name, amen.